Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is struggling to get people vaccinated, and a research study on vaccine messaging does not shed light on a solution.
We don't see any of the messages being particularly effective in Wyoming.
Campbell County will be voting on establishing an independent community college district.
There's really simply nothing that we're going to gain out of it in Campbell County with the economy going backwards.
And this fall is the 50th anniversary of an important experiment that proved Einstein's theory of relativity. The experiment involved a former Laramie man.
If it were to come up in conversation, especially with anybody who is a physicist or has studied physics, they may not know my father's name, but they know his experiment.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's cases of COVID-19 have jumped to over 1,300 active cases, mainly due to the highly contagious Delta variant. But there's also this matter of low vaccination rates of roughly 35% of the population. A group of University of Wyoming researchers recently studied what messages did the best job of convincing people across the country to get vaccinated. UW PhD student Madison Ashworth was the lead author of the paper that appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's the latest in a series of coronavirus-related research conducted by the UW College of Business Economists. She joins me now. Well, Madison, first off, thank you very much for taking time to visit with us. What was the purpose of doing this study?
Doing the study was we were really interested, you know, how we can encourage people to get vaccinated for COVID-19. We knew we were going to face some significant barriers, and our team has been working on the COVID-19 research, and we really just wanted to apply some work that we had already started to the COVID-19 problem, because we did know that, especially in Wyoming, we were going to face some barriers. So we just wanted to kind of do our part and see what we could do to help.
Now, you actually did your research across the country, is that correct?
It's true, yes. So we did, our big study is a national study, but then we also did take our experimental design and apply it to a subsample of Wyoming residents.
Okay. Did you see any differences here in Wyoming versus what you saw nationally?
Yeah, we definitely did. So in our national sample, you know, we tested these different information messages to see how we could encourage vaccine uptake. And in the national sample, we did see a pretty significant effect on some of our messages, specifically the message emphasizing personal health benefits of getting vaccinated. But in Wyoming, we really didn't see any effect of any of our messages. So what we kind of found in comparison to the national samples that Wyoming vaccine rates are particularly sticky in regards to information nudges. So these kind of information messages and campaigns might not be as effective in Wyoming particularly, as they are in the national sample.
Well, that's interesting. We'll get back to that in just a second. So what you found nationally, would you explain what seems to be the most effective?
Of course. So we, in our study, we tested a variety of different information messages. You know, we tested whether emphasizing personal health benefits of getting vaccinated was more important than emphasizing like the social benefits of getting vaccinated. So, you know, the benefits to your local community or your friends and family. We also looked at how important the economic benefits of getting vaccinated were. And what we found was that messages emphasizing the personal health benefits of getting vaccinated was the most effective across the board. And when we did look at combinations of these different messages, we found that combining this personal health benefit message with other messages kind of diluted how powerful that message was. So when we combine all three of our benefit messages, we had a lower vaccine rate than if we just gave the personal benefit message on its own. So there was some diluting, but it wasn't a significant amount that would say, don't give any other messages at all. But there was, it is definitely important to emphasize that personal health benefit.
So the personal health benefit is going to be the most effective in your findings, but it probably, so I guess the question is, I know you've got a lot of famous people, you've got politicians, you've got others who have done messaging. Is all of that useless, do you think?
Definitely not. I don't think it is at all. And, you know, we did our study back before there was actually a vaccine available. So that is one limitation of our study that's important to take into account, is that these are vaccine intentions. And so what we're seeing is that this personal health benefit message is super important to push going forward. But when one thing also with our study is that we didn't look at the source of the information. So, you know, all these famous people, celebrities endorsing the vaccine can be an effective method as well. But one thing we just want to keep in mind when we're kind of having these celebrities or trusted government officials push the vaccine is to keep in mind that they should definitely mention the personal health benefits of getting vaccinated and maybe not focus as much on the social benefits.
Now, Madison, I want to ask you about what you found in Wyoming. What was different here?
So what was different is that we just didn't see an effect of our messages at all. So, for example, in our national survey, the group that didn't have any kind of message given to them, they had a vaccine intention of about 49%. So 49% of the people in that group said they intended to get the COVID-19 vaccine. However, when we gave people the personal benefit information, that intention rate jumped to 65%. So we saw a pretty good increase in the intention to get vaccinated. If we looked at the Wyoming results, we saw in our group that got no message, about 48% of people intended to get the vaccine. And if we looked at our private benefit message, that only jumped to about 50%. So we don't see any of the messages being particularly effective in Wyoming.
That's interesting. Are you in a position to have a hypothesis of why that might be?
In Wyoming, compared to the national sample, we did see a very high number of individuals saying that they didn't think COVID-19 was as severe. So compared to the national sample, just less people said that that was an important reason. So people in Wyoming just don't think COVID's as severe, and it doesn't warrant vaccination. And it makes sense if you look at Wyoming residents. I mean, Wyoming is a pretty rural area. You know, it's a pretty low populated state. So the COVID-19 incidence just hasn't been as high in Wyoming compared to other areas across the globe. And so we just don't see that kind of, that risk isn't as salient to Wyomingites as, say, other places.
When you interviewed people in Wyoming, did you see people in places where you saw more cases more inclined to do the vaccine?
So we didn't look at kind of subsets within Wyoming. We kind of just looked at Wyoming as a whole, right? But what we did see in our results is that people who have had a previous experience with COVID-19 are more likely to get the vaccine. So if you know someone who's had COVID-19 and had like a severe case of it, you are more likely to get vaccinated. So any kind of exposure to COVID-19, of course, we don't want that to happen to anyone. But the more exposure to COVID-19 you have, the more likely you are to get vaccinated. And so I would imagine in the counties and cities in Wyoming that have had higher rates of COVID, you are likely to see some more higher vaccination rates.
I mean, do you have a conclusion or any idea what might work here?
The biggest thing that I've taken away from, especially being a resident, is that information coming from kind of the eye in the sky, the researcher, you know, a pamphlet, or isn't going to be nearly as effective as just talking to your local community members. You know, someone you know and trust, the information coming from them is going to be a lot more important. So I think the best thing you can do if you are someone who wants to encourage people to get vaccinated is just talk to those around you and talk to those around you with understanding. Don't come at it as a fight, but just be empathetic to what their concerns are and really try and address those concerns.
Madison Ashworth is a University of Wyoming PhD student who got to be the lead author of a very interesting paper appearing in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Congratulations on all of this, and thank you for making time for us.
Of course. Thank you so much.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Halley-Keating experiment. That's a test of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Turns out that Joseph Halley, the physicist that worked on the experiment, is a former Laramie resident. Wyoming Public Radio's Adlin Jamaluddin reports.
The Halley-Keating experiment took 4 atomic clocks aboard commercial airliners. They flew twice around the world, first eastward, then westward, and compared the clock against others that remained at the U.S. Naval Observatory. Dr. Michael Pierce is an associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Wyoming.
And the effect that was predicted was both clocks, regardless of what direction they moved, experienced the general relativistic effect of time moving faster the further you get away from the Earth's gravitational field.
So that was viewed as a confirmation of Einstein's prediction. While you might wonder why this matters, Pierce makes it simple. He says if you have any sort of GPS system, you owe a debt of gratitude to Einstein's theory of relativity and to the Halley-Keating experiment that made GPS possible.
Because in order to determine our precise location on Earth, what one does is compare signals that are generated by the GPS satellite system. So all of those calculations by Einstein go into calculating your position on the Earth.
So whenever you pull out your phone and you read your current location, then you must take into account these effects that were verified experimentally by Halley-Keating 50 years ago. Alan Moore, a retired professor in applied statistics at UW, was Halley's personal friend. He says he had the privilege of hearing the stories of the experiment from Joe Halley himself. Some were amusing.
Hearing some of the stories about sometimes having difficulty with customs and people not quite understanding what they were doing with these big machines in the seats of the airplanes, and how skeptical some people were. So just hearing the excitement as he described what that was like was fun for me.
Angie Varka, Halley's third out of four daughters, says she was aware of what he did, but to her, he was just that.
You know, he was working really hard to try to support, you know, a family of six, total six people. He was busy. He was a good father. I would say a loving and a strict father. He liked to share his ideas with us, talk about science.
After losing his tenure at the University of Washington to another professor working on moon rocks, Halley worked at Caterpillar, a machinery company in the research department.
For my father, who felt like maybe it wasn't recognized in its time, I don't think he really kind of reached a place of peace and like self-satisfaction until after he had retired and moved to Laramie.
Varka says her dad never left science, even in retirement.
Even after he retired, he always did experiments. He was always running experiments and continuing to write papers. And he really had a very amazing mind. And, you know, I sometimes ask myself, how would he have dealt with like, what's going on right now? I think he would have seen it as like a challenge and a problem.
She admits that she's very proud of his accomplishments.
If it were to come up in conversation, especially with anybody who is a physicist or has studied physics, they may not know my father's name, but they know his experiment. They know about the experiment that flew atomic clocks around the world to delve into the ideas, Einstein's general relativity. And, you know, it's kind of satisfying to be able to say, that was my dad who did that.
Experts say the Halley-Keating experiment is a timeless finding, giving us ideas about time and GPS location. It is one of the most important experiments in the 20th century. The official anniversary is in October. For Wyoming Public Radio, I am Adlan Jamaluddin.
When we come back, the last wind farm in a public utilities 2017 plan has gone online, and we'll bring you the latest in our ongoing collaborative series on the Colorado River. This is Open Spaces.
A startup is trying to save the planet by developing a special technology. And it could all come together if they manage to win an international competition. It's going to be tough, but folks think this CEO is the guy to do it.
I don't have a good way to put this that doesn't sound cheesy, but kind of like this mythical dude that like just out there to just like be rad and just spread stoke.
Binge all of Carbon Valley now. Listen at carbonvalleypodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. 7 years ago, a pulse of water on the Colorado River at the U.S.-Mexico border temporarily reconnected it to the Pacific Ocean. Scientists used the so-called pulse flow to study what plant and animal life returned to the area along with water. Armed with that knowledge, and even during persistent drought, they're trying a new and more targeted strategy this year. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more.
It's just after sunrise in the Colorado River's dry estuary in Mexico, and Tomas Rivas is hunched over, using his fingers to comb through small bits of wood.
What are you looking for, Tomas?
Jumping spider?
Jumping spider?
Yeah.
Rivas is an ecologist with the conservation group the Sonoran Institute, and we're at the place where the river and the ocean used to meet and mix. The exposed salt flats are home to jumping spiders, tiny turquoise fiddler crabs, and hardy species of saltgrass. The day we visited, it reached 120 degrees with a cloudless sky.
These are harsh conditions here.
Rivas says this part of the delta used to be home to a tidal bore, a wave that forms as the incoming tide rushes against the freshwater river.
In Spanish, here we, the people, locally call burro, el burro, for the tidal bore.
It even had a sound, he says, of crashing, rumbling water.
The people say, ahí viene el burro. It's like the donkey's coming, no?
Because the Colorado River is so overused in the U.S., the burro hasn't charged in the delta in decades. Rivas's group is working to bring water back into this part of the estuary and study it. It won't fully revive the tidal bore, but it will be enough to help restore riverine habitat.
For Mexico, living with a dead river has been, I'll say, sort of a wound.
Jennifer Pitt runs the Colorado River Program for the National Audubon Society. We're upstream of the estuary, next to an irrigation canal, where water diverted near the U.S.-Mexico border makes a hard left turn back into the river's channel.
And this is a little bit of repair.
For a few months this spring and summer, portions of the Colorado River Delta are flowing again. But unlike 2014's pulse flow, this release of water is targeted to restoration sites.
And we're using the irrigation canals to bypass the dry reach and drop the water into the river at the point where the scientists tell us it will do the most good.
The Colorado River is grabbing national headlines as water shortages take hold. Hot and dry conditions are coming home to roost in its reservoirs, dropping the two biggest to record lows. Even in a dry year like this one, Pitt says both the U.S. and Mexico have agreed to set aside water just for the environment.
And if we don't figure out at this moment how to support the river itself and all of nature that it supports, I fear that we lose them permanently.
Not everyone agrees. Some skeptical city leaders and farmers in Mexico say any unused water is wasted.
I am kayaking on the Colorado River in its delta in Mexico. There's dragonflies that are sort of skipping across the water. You'll see birds up in the trees. There's a beaver dam just upstream of here.
This is 1% of the water that's coming from the U.S., and it's building so much into the ecosystem.
That's Rocio Torres. She runs the Sonoran Institute's Colorado River Delta Restoration.
For me, that means, and for our team, that there's hope, right?
Torres says these targeted flows are less flashy and harder to explain than the pulse flow. That event galvanized communities in the region, she says, and it built a base of support from water officials in both countries who agreed to set aside a small amount of water not for human use.
I think that's the way human beings, we learn, we mess things up, we realize we really shouldn't have done that.
And she says, bringing it back happens little by little. I'm Luke Runyon in Sonora, Mexico.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River produced by KUNC with support from the Walton Family Foundation. A utility has put the largest wind farm in its system fully online here in Wyoming. TB Flats, located in Carbon County, can generate around 500 megawatts of power from 132 wind turbines. It's the last step for PacifiCorp's Energy Vision 2020 plan that created more than 1,000 megawatts of new wind in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with the utility's Dave Eskelson.
It's the last wind project to come online stemming from our Energy Vision 2020 projects. And that was a key part of our strategy, you know, stemming from the 2017 Integrated Resource Plan and being able to capture production tax credits for those projects greatly reduced the cost of them for our customers. So we wanted to be able to take advantage of that for 2020. And of course, along with the three new wind projects was the repowering of all of our existing wind projects, plus the completion of some very important segments of the Energy Gateway transmission project. And all of that's been done now.
Okay, so this was really a concluding moment for Rocky Mountain Power.
Well, it is. There are some details, on the construction and commercial operation details that we do around these projects. So there's still some details to do before things are really done. But all of those wind projects are now generating electricity.
So in my head, when all of these turbines go online, it's some dramatic flipping of the switch where all of it starts slowly rolling into reality. What is it actually?
Well, generally, it's a process. You know, once the turbines themselves are constructed, they go through a period of testing, each one, and connections are made to the substation at the site where the generating output from all of those different turbines is gathered and put on the company's transmission network. And then, of course, there are control systems to be tested. It's not like it's a big switch that is flipped, but generally when these projects are completed, there is a point at which they've passed the testing phase and are in the operational phase. And then there's a period of time where they are operating in kind of a test mode, but they are producing electricity for customers. And then once all of those final arrangements have been made, we classify them as commercially operational. And that that has yet to happen for TB Flats, but it will happen soon.
So the Energy Vision 2020 plan was one thing. Is this larger renewable energy proposal, is that apart from that, a larger sort of next step?
Well, one of the things that has been happening really in the last three or four integrated resource planning cycles is that the economics of renewable energy and renewable energy with storage has scored really well in terms of its overall cost to customers, which is one of the major metrics we use in our resource planning. The other major metric we have is reliability. So as we plan for the future, we try to anticipate what our customers are going to need 10, 20 years into the future. Now that's pretty difficult to forecast exactly, but we do try to make the best forecast we can. And it's also one of the reasons why the resource plan is updated every other year, because that's always changing. And we want to be able to make sure that our planning is refreshed regularly so that we provide what customers need when they need it. And the balancing of customer need day to day, hour to hour, against our generation output, because that has to be balanced every minute of every day, is a critical part of the job we do.
Okay, well, thanks, Steve.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Rocky Mountain Power is now whittling down its choices for its next projects after receiving proposals in 2020. When we come back, the proposal to make Gillette College an independent district is up for a vote this month, plus the start of a Mountain West News Service series on tribal jails. This is Open Spaces. Thank you.
The Modern West Podcast, audio storytelling with a finger on the pulse of the West.
That was the last wolf that Dad had heard of in the valley.
Journey into a morphing world.
It's all because property. Of the coal mine. Yeah. I mean, it was a good living.
Where old stereotypes fall apart.
All right, Gladys, are we ready to give that girl their scars?
And you get to be yourself. Binge episodes now at themodernwest.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Residents of Campbell County will soon vote on the future of its community college. The vote will ask residents if they want to separate from the Northern Wyoming Community College District and become an independent one. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler explains how the issue came up for a vote and what it will mean if it passes.
This whole ordeal started back in the summer of 2020 after the Northern Wyoming Community College District announced major budget cuts that came along from the state's economic crisis and the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. District President Walt Tribley says there have been attempts in Campbell County to separate from the district before, but this time was different.
The first time that really it was very publicly and very clearly communicated was in reaction to the cuts that were made by the district in very, very challenging times.
For many in Gillette, it started as a fight about the elimination of athletic programs. After passing several hurdles since last summer, this month on August 17th, the community will vote on what it wants to do, become an independent community college district, or stay in their current situation. The Northern Wyoming Community College District is made up of Sheridan College in Johnson County, and Gillette College. Sheridan County is the taxing county for the district, meaning the county-based businesses and residents pay the taxes that partially fund it. But it also means the county gets full representation on the district's board of trustees. And for many, that's another major issue.
When you have an elected board of trustees making decisions and they are connected to their community, all your decisions then are relative to the community's needs.
That's Mark Englert. He's supporting the college to become independent. Englert worked for the district for 33 years and is the former vice president of Gillette College. He says with the ultimate control lying in Sheridan right now, it doesn't allow for Gillette to be as flexible.
It's incumbent upon that community college to be able to respond in a timely manner to those needs, whether it be full-blown academic programs or a certificate program or even select courses. And if you can't do that, if you don't have the ability to make those decisions that serves that local need, then fundamentally, you're not a true community college.
But to become independent, Gillette will have to vote to tax itself, possibly between 2 and 4 mills, a hard sell in Campbell County. But Englert says it's a worthwhile investment.
We acknowledge the cost, that it is a tax, it's a property tax. There's no getting around it. But for example, for a homeowner who has a $300,000 home, if the trustees opted to levy 3 mills, that is an $85.50 investment per year to support the college.
Campbell County State Representative Bill Fortner begs to disagree.
The reason being is there's really simply nothing that we're going to gain out of it in Campbell County with the economy going backwards.
Fortner says the added tax would be a burden for property owners and businesses, and it's not something the community should take on during this period of economic uncertainty.
This is a tax that's a direct attack on extraction industry, uranium, coal, oil, and gas in Campbell County. Not only is that the food chain for Campbell County, it's the food chain for the rest of the state. The state depends on Campbell County to do good.
Fortner says, in his opinion, the trustees in Sheridan and the district itself have done a good job. He's happy to keep having the neighboring county footing the bill. But Englert says there's a value in retraining a local workforce, and with business leaders he's spoken to, they agree.
They realize the value of a community college in making sure that you continue to have a well-prepared workforce, even if the business has to change, even if they have to change the direction and look at different markets. You have to have something in place where you're not trying to attract workers from outside, but you can prepare them locally.
But even if the county approves, there's still a long way to go. it will take years for Gillette College to be fully accredited on its own and to separate itself completely from the district. District President Walt Tribley says despite the financial impacts this could have, he hopes they are successful.
Make no mistake that this college is where it is today due to the industry, the hard work, the vision, the passion, the money of the folks in Campbell County, and very much so because boards of trustees have supported it, presidents have supported it, staff have supported every bit of that growth. So I think that moving forward, I'd love to see people in Campbell County support an institution of higher education.
Tribley says if it does pass, the district will still be there for students and staff, and the relationship won't disappear. And if it doesn't pass,
it's going to be all right. There'll be some issues that we'll have to talk about. I mean, obviously, there's some issues here. On August 18th, regardless of the vote, the students are enrolled in Northern Wyoming Community College classes. Faculty are in place. Our staff are in place. Our administrators are in place. We're budgeted for the year this way or that way. We're here for the education of our students.
The Campbell County special election will be held on August 17th, with early voting already underway. Along with voting on whether to establish a new community college district, residents will also be able to vote for 7 people to be the potential new district's board of trustees. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
A 22-year-old grocery store worker, a mother of 4, a day laborer. These are all people who have died in tribal jails overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the past few years. They were arrested for petty misdemeanors like public intoxication or stealing a couple of beers, but their incarceration was a death sentence. An investigation by the Mountain West News Bureau has discovered a pattern of neglect, mismanagement, and poor training that led to at least 19 people dying in these jails since 2016. The series is supported by the Pulitzer Center. Reporter Nate Hedgie starts us off by explaining that the federal government has known about these problems for years.
It was a typically hot, muggy June day in Washington, D.C. when Inspector General Earl Devaney sat down in front of senators.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It was 2004. The Iraq War was raging. President Bush was in a heated battle for re-election. But on this day, the senators were about to hear troubling testimony about the more than 70 detention centers overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
BIA's detention program is riddled with problems, and in our opinion, is a national disgrace, with many facilities having conditions comparable to those found in third world countries.
An investigation by Devaney's office found more than 800 serious incidents at these jails. They included deaths, attempted suicides, and escapes. One man was found hanging in his cell after being left unmonitored for 2 hours. And on the Yakima Reservation in Washington State, they found a woman who was confined in a windowless cell. She hadn't seen daylight for nearly 2 weeks. Devaney said the conditions were a violation of basic civil rights.
Nothing, however, less than a Herculean effort to turn these conditions around would be morally acceptable.
Senators introduced legislation that would reform the BIA corrections program, but it failed to pass. Meanwhile, the agency promised change. Over the next 2 decades, it introduced a new policy handbook, bolstered training, and rebuilt about a third of its jails. Congress gave the detention center program a slight boost in funding, but it was nowhere near the estimated $135 million the agency says it needs. And today, the death toll remains the same.
There's basically really hasn't been any kind of major improvement.
Ed Naranjo is a former BIA official and whistleblower who helped spur the 2004 investigation. He isn't surprised the BIA failed to complete its overhaul of the detention center program.
There's not enough resources and people to address those issues. And so as a result, you know, nothing's done.
That inaction cost a 22-year-old grocery store worker named Willie Pepian his life. I meet his mom, Wilma Fleury, at her home on the Blackfeet Reservation in north central Montana. Pepian's dog, Shooter, greets me. He's a pit bull mix.
Hey, Shooter, how are you?
Huh?
It's been more than a year since Pepian died at the BIA-operated jail on the reservation. His mom has taken down all of his pictures. They're tucked away in a closet because seeing them is too painful.
My one friend told me, she goes, some days, Wilma, you feel like you're going crazy. So when I start feeling like that, I usually go outside or I take a long walk, be by myself. But Then I get really angry.
She's angry because of how her son died. Pepien was at a house when a fight broke out and someone hit him in the head with a shovel. When police arrived, they arrested him. He was taken to a hospital where doctors cleared him to spend the day in jail, but they missed a serious injury. The shovel had cracked his skull. No one from the hospital would comment. When police took him to the jail, he had dried blood on his face. Frederick Noon Jr. says he was in jail with Pepien that day.
He asked that jailer, I need help.
Noon says he tried to get the guard's attention on Pepien's behalf.
I was like, hey, this guy needs help. He's pretty sick. Then she was like, no, lay down, go pass out.
Federal policy says guards are supposed to take someone to a health clinic if they ask for help like this. But records show correctional officers never brought Pepien back to the hospital. Noon says for the next few hours, Pepien was in pain.
He wouldn't let his head touch his pillow. It's like he's protecting his head. He looked like a little baby, you know, falling asleep and he's bobbing his head up and down, moaning and groaning.
Federal policy requires guards to personally check on inmates every 30 minutes. They look for signs of life. But at the Blackfeet jail, they broke the rules that day. Pepien's body wasn't discovered until nearly 3 hours after he died. We reached out to the BIA, but officials declined to comment. His mom, Wilma Fleury, says she was calling all day to find out when her son was going to get out of jail. She just thought he was in there for being drunk. The guards kept telling her he'd be released once he was sober, but then, that night, a sheriff's deputy showed up at her door.
He goes, what's Willie to you? And I thought right away that maybe something happened to him and they're taking him to the hospital or something. I go, he's my son, why? And he goes, I'm sorry to tell you, but he passed away. And I go, I said, I've been calling all day to see if he was going to get out. That's my boy. That's my youngest kid.
Pepien died on Mother's Day. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Once again, we are looking into the deaths at the more than 70 jails overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We discovered a pattern of negligence, mismanagement, and a lack of training. In fact, 1 in 5 correctional guards working in these jails have not even completed the required basic training to do their jobs. That includes the 2 guards who oversaw the last hours of Carlos Yazzie's life. The 44-year-old day laborer died at a jail in New Mexico. Once again, here's Nate Hedgie.
Carlos Yazzie's brother, Chris, is standing on land his family has owned for generations. It's beautiful red rock desert in the northern part of the Navajo Nation. But for Chris, it carries a lot of bad memories.
We always grew up with a lot of shame, you know, a lot of guilt, a lot of heartache because my stepdad, you know, he was just kind of a heartless man, you know, he only thought of himself.
He says his stepdad was an alcoholic Marine veteran who used to beat his kids.
He would just take his knuckle and just get you right on the head, man, and you'd just be, you know, you'd be in pain for about 10, 15 minutes, man, and he did stuff like that because, you know, you couldn't see the bumps on your head, man, you know.
Chris says that relentless abuse drove many of his siblings towards drugs and alcohol, including Carlos, his older brother. Carlos was a big guy in his mid-40s with a dark complexion.
You know, straight hair, he kind of had a little mullet going on.
He was a hard worker with a talent for masonry. That is, when he wasn't drinking.
A lot of times he acknowledged, you know, hey, I'm a drunk. Yeah, I'm addicted to alcohol.
That addiction put Carlos in and out of jails his entire life, including the night of his death. But on that final night, he arrived desperately needing medical attention. His right foot was swollen and his blood alcohol content was estimated to be 0.461. That's 6 times the legal limit. Ian Paul is a forensic pathologist for New Mexico's Office of the Medical Investigator. He says anything over 0.3 is considered potentially lethal.
The vast majority of people couldn't function at all and in fact would be comatose at a concentration of 0.461.
Jail records show that authorities knew Yazzie was intoxicated and argumentative, but they decided he was healthy enough to stay in the jail. He was put in a cramped isolation cell. They were supposed to check on him every 30 minutes. That's federal policy. But he was left unmonitored for 6 hours. A guard found his body in the morning as he was handing out orange jumpsuits. An autopsy report that was supervised by Paul found that Carlos died from acute alcohol poisoning. a condition that's easily treatable at a hospital.
The standard treatment would be a tube placed into the trachea to help his breathing, intubation, and place him on a breathing machine for a few hours until his blood alcohol concentration would have decreased.
Back at his house on the Navajo Nation, Chris Yazzie says, sure, his brother was a severe alcoholic, but maybe that night would have been a turning point for him.
The corrections officers are basically, you know, are holding these lives in their hands with their decisions, you know.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Navajo Department of Corrections declined to comment on Yazzie's case, but jail records show that both of the guards on duty had not completed the basic required training at the Indian Police Academy to do their jobs. This training includes 400 classroom hours of CPR, first aid, and how to deal with intoxicated inmates. Federal investigators and correctional officers say the Indian Police Academy has a chronic backlog. Ophelia Begay is the supervisor at a jail in nearby Window Rock, Arizona.
You know, when you first come aboard, you are required to be certified, to become certified within 1 year, but that does not happen.
For example, she's been pushing 2 years to get one of her female guards certified.
I cannot leave her alone. She has to have someone all the time with her.
That's because under federal policy, an untrained guard shouldn't be left alone. But sometimes staff shortages mean that happens, as it did during the final hours of Yazzie's life. And a lack of training isn't the only problem at many of these facilities. There are also no doctors or nurses on staff. And that had deadly results for both Yazzie and a 33-year-old mother of four named Brandy Skunkcap. Her story is next in our series. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
When we come back, we'll talk to the author of a new book on Mountain Man Jim Bridger. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die.
Or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the Modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Jerry Ensler is founder and president emeritus of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. He's written and curated national exhibitions and films. Mr. Ensler has recently published the first comprehensive biography of legendary mountain man Jim Bridger, trailblazer of the American West. Grady Kirkpatrick recently spoke with Mr. Ensler about the new book.
Bridger has been considered the king of the mountain men with a larger-than-life history that continues to capture our imaginations. He was a big part of westward expansion and exploration beginning in the early 1820s. Without giving too much away, what are some of the new details you uncovered about Bridger's life that are included in the book?
Well, I mean, even in his early life, the earlier biographers have said that Jim Bridger apprenticed to a St. Louis blacksmith. And he actually apprenticed to an Illinois gunsmith, and a very notable gunsmith, Philip Creamer, who was one of the most remarkable gunsmiths in the Midwest at that time. And shortly after apprenticing there, he actually lived among the Potawatomis, which is also an unknown fact until now. We knew that he was at an Indian agency, but we didn't realize it was the Potawatomis. And just a few years earlier, Bridger and his family were afraid of being raided by the Potawatomis during the War of 1812, and now he was helping them out and getting a different perspective.
What sources did you research for some of the new material in the book?
Some of the best resources have been the National Archives. At the University of Wyoming, the American Heritage Center is a tremendous resource. The Wisconsin Historical Society had some good information, because there was a professor in the 1880s who wanted to write a biography of Bridger. He never finished it, but he collected a lot of information, and I was able to access that information at the State Historical Society of Wisconsin archive in Madison.
What are some of Jim Bridger's accomplishments and events that he's best known for?
not only was he known for these, but he was known for them at such a young age. When he was 18 years old, he went up the Missouri River all the way to the Wyoming-Montana area. And when he was 21, he was by that time, actually at age 20, he was the first known to discover that the Salt Lake was actually a salt lake, not just a freshwater lake, 20 years old. Also at 21, he was running the Bad Pass Rapids on the Bighorn River, which the Crow had said that there's a great evil Manitou, an evil spirit up there who would devour you. When he was 22, he was among the first group of Euro-Americans to enter what is today the boundaries of Yellowstone. And by the time he was 24, he knew the terrain better than almost anyone in the Henry Ashley, Smith Jackson and Sublette, and later Rocky Mountain Fur Companies. And he was often the pilot for those who were running and owning these companies.
And that's just his early history. I mean, it goes
That's just
on.
His early, yeah. Right. He was a kid when he was doing these things. When you think of what I've done when I'm 24, it was nothing. I graduated from college. There you go.
Yeah. Wow. That is, I mean, it was an incredible life. Many Wyomingites are aware of his namesake at places in the state and the region, Bridger-Teton National Forest, and of course, historic Fort Bridger in southwest Wyoming. You recently visited Wyoming for book signings, and you also traveled to some of the Bridger landmarks and historic sites in the state, right?
Absolutely. Well, I was at Pinedale, Wyoming, and that's along the Green River where the Horse Creek comes into the Green River, and that's where most of the, or more rendezvous were held at that site than any of the other fur trade rendezvous. And these were an annual trading fair. It was typical for a trapper maybe to go home after 3, 4, 5 years, maybe come back, take a trip to St. Louis again, come back. Bridger stayed out there for 17 years and just came to the annual rendezvous to get coffee and sugar and maybe a new set of clothing and whatever else he needed, and traps, and kept on going. So I was at the Museum of the Mountain Man, and I was at the National Trails Museum in Casper, and that's right along the North Platte River. And Bridger was instrumental in finding a new route called the Bridger Trail late in his career, which was instrumental in trying to help keep peace with the Lakota and the Sioux and the Arapaho. The Army didn't pay any attention to Bridger, unfortunately, so there was 3 years of war, but it was there. And that war actually was fought near Sheridan in Wyoming. And there's a fort there, Fort Phil Kearny. And Bridger was stationed at Fort Laramie and Fort Phil Kearny and Fort C.F. Smith, and was an extremely notable figure during all that time. Some people call it Red Cloud's War. And Bridger was extremely knowledgeable about what the soldiers should and shouldn't do. And some of the soldiers, fresh from the Civil War, thought that they knew how to fight, but they did not know how to do battle with indigenous peoples who were so used to the landscape.
Many Euro-Americans of the 18th and 19th century did not have a great deal of respect for Native Americans, to put it mildly. However, some of the mountain men that arrived in the West, including Jim Bridger, had a lot of respect and an enlightened attitude towards indigenous people. And you mentioned earlier his time among the Potawatomis. I expect that had a big influence on him.
I think so. He was only 12 and 13, and he and his family had traveled during the War of 1812, and they arrived at the American Bottom in Illinois, and they were under almost constant fear of attack by the Potawatomis because the Potawatomis had joined with the British in the War of 1812. And now suddenly, at 12 years old, Bridger is now helping them with their trade goods and helping the blacksmith to repair their materials. And so he was actually living in a friendly way with families of Indians, not raiding Potawatomis. And then, so Bridger's first wife was a woman of the Salish tribe, or Flathead. She died at an early age after three children. And then he married a Ute woman, and she died after her first child in birth with Jim Bridger. And then he married a Shoshone woman named Mary, and she lived a little longer, but he also survived her. But he had a strong feeling of more kinship, and is at the same time, don't get into a battle if you don't need to. There was a point where they were following the Blackfeet Indians, and they were suffering. The Indians were suffering from the smallpox, and they could see the bodies that are being left behind by this traveling village of Blackfeet. And Kit Carson and Joe Meek and Osborne Russell, they all wanted to go and attack this suffering village. And Bridger said, no, and my men are not going to do that. So they separated at that point. The free trappers like Carson did make that attack. And they all three of those men wrote about it in their journals and the people that they killed. And Bridger told his men not to participate in any way.
Jerry Ensler, it's been a pleasure talking with you. And I wanted to ask if you have more book signing scheduled in Wyoming. It's in September.
Yes, I do. In fact, on September 2nd, I will be at the Sheridan Public Library and in Sheridan, Wyoming. And on September 4th and 5th, I will be at Fort Bridger. That's the occasion of their annual rendezvous reenactment. And they have almost 10,000 people a day coming. And I'll be there giving a talk once a day on both Saturday and Sunday. Great. September 4th and 5th.
Thank you again. Jerry Ensler, author of the new biography, Jim Bridger, Trailblazer of the American West, available now in bookstores, online, and ourpress.com. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can find the entire show in individual segments at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Or get our podcast at all the usual places. And you can also find our stories on social media and on the station Facebook page. Anna Rader is our digital editor. We enjoy hearing good ideas for interviews or features. You can submit those to us via Facebook or on our website. Also, please support Open Spaces with your financial gift today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.